Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 22nd, 2021. I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And before we get to our guest this week, I want to take a moment to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible. And remember, there are a lot of ways to support the show. It is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of the support of individuals just like you. You can rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can shop at the Talk Nerdy store, or of course, you can join the Patreon gang at patreon.com/talknerdy. This week's top patrons are Mary Neva, Michael Goucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Scott Sanders, Ulrika Hagman, and Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so very much. All right, let's talk about this week's show. I am thrilled because I was able to sit down with an old friend, Riley Black, to talk all about paleo. So Riley is kind of the queen of the paleo world. She has written so many interesting books, Written in Stone, My Beloved Brontosaurus, Skeleton Keys, and also is a freelance writer for a ton of publications, from Nat Geo to Smithsonian, even writing for the Jurassic World franchise. And she spends quite a bit of time doing field work herself and really digging deep into the history of organisms on this planet. So I'm thrilled that after several years, we were able to link back up. So without any further ado, here she is, Riley Black. Well, Riley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's been a million years or 10 million years or something like that.
Oh my gosh, it's been so long. I mean, the last time that you were on the show was like, I don't even know, ages and ages ago. It was in person, right? We were able to record face to face.
It was.
Yeah,
I was going back and forth to LA quite a bit. So we did it in person. I think it was like right around the time, like, I don't think My Beloved Brontosaurus had just come out, but it was like within a year. Or so, so it must have been like 6 or so years ago, I guess.
You're right. We were talking about My Beloved Brontosaurus, and maybe what your next book was, Skeleton Keys?
Yes.
Or is that the first? Yeah, I think maybe we were talking about Skeleton Keys as if it were in process.
Yeah, I think I had just signed the contract for that. I thought, I'm going to have this done within a year, and it took 4 years. So
amazing. Amazing. And so where are you? I'm looking now. Okay, here's your about page. Because I'm like, how many books have you freaking written, Riley? Like, you're so prolific. Where are you at in terms of your career, in terms of what you've been up to lately? Okay, so I'm seeing My Beloved Brontosaurus, Written in Stone. That was your first. I'm seeing Skeleton Keys, like we mentioned, and I'm seeing all these really cool like kids books and kids projects that you've been working on.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like tattoos, right? Like, I've accumulated so many that I kind of forget what's there. They need to stop and think. I think the count for books right now is at 6, and I'm working on 7 and 8. And I've done a couple of children's books. Those have been primarily work for hire stuff for the publisher. Says like, we want someone to write about dinosaurs. Marley knows the stuff. And I can just kind of do it relatively quickly. So the books for adults, the things like My Beloved Brontosaurus and Skeleton Keys, that's still kind of like what my passion projects are, what I really love doing. And then just on top of that, continuing to freelance, I'm still working with the Jurassic World franchise on their dino stuff. So if you buy one of the dinosaur toys and you hit the QR code, you open that up, like whatever's written about that animal, I gave them that information and wrote through that with them. I do a lot of writing for Smithsonian and National Geographic and Slate and just as many different things as I can kind of get my paws on, really. Still doing the freelance thing.
I love that so much. Yeah, I mean, I know that your byline comes up for me all the time, almost any time that there's a new discovery or a new way to analyze or a new way to think about anything in the paleontological record. I'm often seeing pieces that you've written. And I'm wondering now, I think a good question would be for those who remember the earlier episode with you, they may not be able to find it because at the time your name was not Riley Black. And so the byline has changed. And I know you, for a while, you were writing under kind of your pseudonym, right? Under Laylap.
That's right. Or at least that's how a lot of people knew me. That was the blog title. And I just kind of informally got known as that. Yeah.
Yeah. But before, you were writing under Brian Switek, which was your kind of your given name, your original born name. And that's now your dead name.
Right. Yeah. It's been a really wild couple of years. I came out as trans on Thanksgiving Day of 2018. I think it was.
It's been that long.
Well, that's the weird thing. There's so many people I know, especially with the pandemic and everything. Like, you know, we basically lost a year, and I just started transitioning the year before that. So now when I go back to academic conferences, or if I meet people again, like, I'm meeting them as a whole new person. So there are people that I talk to, you know, on a near daily basis that, like, I have not seen since I started taking estrogen. So this is going to be a very interesting year coming up after we all get our vaccines and start to come out again.
Right. And I mean, gosh, there's a million things that I want to parse out. But the first thing that even that comes up for me before we even get into, you know, a little bit about your history is within the paleontology community, clearly, you know, you're somebody who's been writing and analyzing this work for basically, it's been your career. So you work very closely with academics. You work very closely at conferences with paleontologists. And let's be clear, although there's some diversity, although there are some women, there are probably, you know, not nearly as many trans women. You're dealing with a lot of old white dudes. How are they? How open and receptive are they? How understanding are they? I mean, how do you not get down when you're meeting with people and kind of having to say, yes, we met before. This is kind of, you know, I've got a new name. I, you know, this is my gender, and deal with it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and you don't need to kind of sugarcoat, like, we are not a very diverse field. We are lagging behind even other scientific disciplines. Like, the number of paleontologists who are Black is 1%, maybe even less than 1%. Of the field. And oftentimes they're not recognized. Many of them are working in Africa, like working on, you know, hominin fossil sites and stuff, and they never get the credit that they deserve. So this is still a huge thing. I think we're still fighting the fight to have just gender equity and equality between cisgender women and the rest of the field. So it's kind of like everybody else sometimes just a feeling kind of like, wait your turn. It's like, no, we need to, like, everybody in. Like, we need everybody right now. So far, the reception from my peers and colleagues and people that I talk to has been good. Like, people who know me and have followed my work for a long time, like, it didn't skip a beat for them. You know, I've heard a few people say that, you know, like, I remember who you were, but you see much more of yourself now. And that's always great after going through so many changes. Where I've run into, not even pushback, but just like the weirdness of these things is, you know, I live in a red state. I live in Salt Lake City in Utah. Most of the field work that I do is in relatively rural and relatively conservative areas. And there are folks who are not all that happy that I'm around, or assume, especially this was true during the first year of my transition when I wasn't really presenting differently yet. And that was this whole thing of trying to figure out, how do I change my expression while I'm waiting for the hormones to work and everything else. So, like, I didn't look all that different, even though I was identifying different. And the things that you overhear when people think you're not in the room, basically, can be pretty horrific or even dangerous. And that's the part that gets me. Like, I'm at the point where if a paleontologist doesn't want to talk to me because I'm trans or something like that, it's like, it's really their loss at this point. The only weird thing I actually had was with a science journalist person, an editor at a magazine that I'd written for before. And this wasn't bad. It was just kind of strange to me because I emailed them with a pitch for a story I wanted to write. And they turned the pitch down. They didn't think it was interesting enough. And they got an email back saying, like, by the way, like, what are your qualifications for writing about paleontology? And I wrote, this was someone who I worked with for a number of years, a number of stories. I was still using the same email address that stole my footer with all the books and everything else that
so
I wrote.
They just didn't look past your name.
Yep, exactly.
In a way, it's almost like I can imagine there would be ambivalent feelings that come with that, like frustration to be like, wait, what? But also kind of like, wow, they really see me as kind of this new version, this new person. They don't even remember who Brian Svitek was.
Yeah, and the strange part about that is, like, I put my pronouns in the footer of every email that I send, and, you know, I'm pretty forthright about this, or at least pretty direct about the fact that, you know, I used to write under a different name, because that's part of the difficulty. Like, I came out just before my book Skeleton Keys did. So I was kind of like, okay, how do I possibly navigate this? And sometimes I catch it because when people do email introductions, they're usually emailing somebody else about me. And that's where some of the misgendering and stuff slips in. It's often not intentional, but it's kind of like a look of like, okay, are people kind of getting it? Or are they kind of stuck with the old vision? And there are things like, I'm sure some people on this podcast might notice, like, I haven't changed my voice. I haven't done vocal therapy. So, like, anytime I pick up the phone for a story, sometimes people don't know kind of who they're talking to, or I get surd a lot. So there's always a lot of explanation for this.
Right. And I can imagine that. I mean, I'm wondering what it's like for you to feel that you constantly have to explain. Like, on one hand, maybe that's really empowering. On the other hand, does it ever get tiring?
It's really tiring. It's tiring right now, especially in our current, you know, sort of political moment. I think it's more like I try and play it off as much as I can. I think my pat response sometimes, when somebody asked me, my car got ran into in a parking lot the other day, so I had to take it to a place to get repaired. And I guess my registration had my dead name on it, and even though everything else had been updated. So when I went to go into the garage to get my car repaired, they said, like, oh, are you Brian? And I said, well, I used to be, but I got better. And things like that, like, that helps a little bit and adds a little bit of levity. Because the thing that I found, like, the weirdest thing to me about the reaction to transgender identities, right? And this is something that, like, I've primarily experienced. I know it's different for many other people, but it's the primary reaction that I run into is not so much hate. It's annoyance. It's annoyance at this idea that, like, oh, now I got to ask about people's pronouns and their identities, and I got to keep this thing in my head. That's the thing, like, more than anything else, just randomly. You know, I remember once I thanked somebody for gendering me correctly, and they were just like, yeah, just don't shove it down my throat or anything. And I'm like, I'm not shoving anything down your throat. I'm just asking you to, you know, please use she, her. And that's
It sounds to me like there's this mentality. I mean, sounds to me, I've seen it. I know that it exists where people almost feel like, because of their privilege, like they're burdened by, you know, the existence. Like, all you want, all you're asking for is to be able to be yourself, and for other people to not even necessarily agree, not even like you, not even want to be your friend, but just acknowledge you as you are.
Yeah, the way I describe it sometimes is like, imagine if you had a nickname that you got in like elementary school that you really hated. And, you know, since that time, I mean, you not only have your own name, but, like, let's say change your name or something else. But imagine if people just kept calling you that name in perpetuity, and you constantly had to correct them. It starts to wear away. You start like, is that my identity to everybody else? Like, why is this continuing? And that's the way that it kind of feels when this happens. And most of it's like, I'm relatively loud, I'd say, about my trans identity. Like, I wrote a piece for Slate recently, or I'm doing another one. Like, I think that's really important because I'm fascinated with so many aspects of this, the science and culture of it, and all these different facets of it. But I think really, like, what I would love most would be not having to do this, like, not having to educate people and really dig into this, just kind of like exist.
Right.
And I have, like, you know, Riley Black is a writer who happens to be trans. But I think especially now, you know, it's kind of a blessing and a curse in that, like, it's great to talk about my experience, my identity, and hope that that speaks to other people who need that encouragement right now. But the future I want to get to is where, you know, you just don't assume somebody's pronouns, or you just ask them, or that becomes a normal part of this thing. And it's not like, you don't feel like you're asking somebody to walk over broken glass to call you by your preferred pronouns.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel in my heart of hearts like that is the future that will exist. And part of it is a function of cultural recognition and cultural growth that we were seeing in survey data that, you know, millennials and younger are identifying as trans or identifying as non-binary in significantly higher numbers than boomers. And clearly, it's not that these individuals have, there are just more trans people now. It's that more trans people are able to say it and own it and come out with it and be, you know, less afraid or less. I mean, obviously, there's still so much violence and there's still so much retaliation, but there's strength in numbers, as we saw with the Me Too movement. It's not that those women were not being abused. They were just suffering in silence.
Yeah. And I wonder about that in terms of like when I came out and the fact that I have an entire cohort of friends who also are trans who came out at about the same time. And how is this idea of generational turnover? Like, I feel like not that it's entirely bimodal, but that we have a lot of people who are coming out as trans and genderqueer and non-binary who are in Gen Z and below. But there's also a lot of people, I guess, on like the deeper end of the millennial pool, like I am, that are coming out because, you know, our parents are boomers. And for us, we grew up seeing stuff like, you know, Maury episodes about sex change operations or like, you know, transgender people were often like the butts of jokes on shows like, you know, The Critic and The Simpsons and stuff like that. It was just kind of everywhere. Like, I remember having feelings about this from about the age of 10, at least. But it was always like, well, I couldn't possibly do that. And if I do, like, people are going to, you know, think a whole bunch of terrible things about me. Like, it wasn't safe to do that. So now through one way or another, that's becoming so much a part of the conversation. Like, yes, this is possible to do. I think it's really not only speaking to younger folks, but people who like felt like they had to go through so much of their life. One way it's like, actually, I don't have to do that anymore. And that's one of the awesome things I think about transitioning and about some aspects of medically transitioning, that you can go through your second puberty at any time. Like, you take these hormones and your body knows what to do with them, whether you're 15 or 50. And I think that's pretty rad from a biological standpoint.
That's so rad. And, you know, I'm glad that you bring up kind of the medical transition side of it, because working within this sort of psychology world, which is, you know, usually, well, I don't want to say usually, but at least, how do I say this? Working from a humanistic existential perspective, which does tend to be more pro-social, tends to be more social justice oriented. You know, I'm surrounded by incredible practitioners who are all about, you know, affirming identity. And I've seen a really significant change even within the medical establishment where, you know, something that used to be called a quote sex change operation or diagnostics that used to be kind of couched in terms of pathology, in terms of disorder, in terms of something being wrong, is now being turned on its ear. And what we're talking about is gender affirming surgery. And we're talking about psychotherapy to help an individual discover their true selves and to live their best lives. And, you know, now is a time where, yes, there are places, there are corners of this country where that's not available to people. And it's infuriating and deeply saddening. But I'm so thrilled to see that there are other corners of this country where that is becoming increasingly available.
Yeah, and I think some of the sort of volume that we're hearing from transphobic sources now is because they kind of know that the writing is on the wall and that they're going to be made irrelevant, that this is, you know, especially living in Salt Lake and the fact that, like, you know, I'm kind of part of the counterculture here because we have something to push back against. And I think that's a similar effect that's going on just in the opposite direction, where they can see how, like, you know, the next generation's like, it's not going to be weird or unusual use they, them pronouns, or to consider puberty blockers or hormone replacement therapy, or these other things that are concepts of gender and what it means in bodily autonomy are going to rapidly change. And a lot of this stuff, like, you know, Abigail Schreier, who's written for the Wall Street Journal, wrote an awful book called Irreversible Damage, basically saying how there's this epidemic of young women, you know, rather than identifying as lesbians, they identify as trans instead. And it's just like, I think she testified like on the Hill today, like just spouting off the same kind of stuff.
Oh, and I saw that even, I just recently rewatched The L Word, and I remember one of the sentiments that you saw a lot around Max's character was people coming up to him and saying things like, please don't do this, we're losing all of our butch women. And that there was even within the lesbian community, this real pushback.
Oh yeah, and that still exists. That's something that I've run into, and a former partner of mine ran into as well. Just like this idea of like, why can't you just be happy in the body that you have? Why do you have to change? That is a loss to whatever community that you're a part of, that you want to change. And it's kind of this like deficit model of like gender and sexuality. That's just very strange to me.
Right.
And
instead of saying, why can't we open the community up to accept all of us?
Right. Or learn that just like that variation is the rule. Like so much of this, it reminds me of like trying to put biology in boxes and saying like, you know, there are men and there are women, and gender relates to what your biological sex is, and that relates to your sexuality. It's all connected, but it's very set, and this is what it is, and you need to pick these categories. And anything that was outside that, it's like, well, that's strange. That's odd. That needs a special explanation. And I think it plays into some of this annoyance as well. Like you're asking for special treatment or special care, or why should I pay for, you know, your sex change surgery? Or is an argument that I've heard. Instead of realizing that maybe the variation is the message that, you know, biological sex is a real thing, but maybe just binary biological sexes is not covering the reality of what it is to be human. And that we need to change our definition, because I think people often forget, especially in this moment where science is so misused by some, that science is a process of understanding the world around us. There is a reality that we wish to understand, but reality and science are not synonymous with each other. Science is the process that, and our ideas change, the labels we use change. We have this artifice and this edifice that's kind of built up to try and understand things, but that means that sometimes we have to change our definitions. Or say like, okay, we have this whole group of people that don't fit in either of these categories. We need to change something. And I think that's the struggle that we're having, where it's like this argument from authority without questioning where that authority came from and why we're listening to it.
And how like stunning as an individual who works within paleontology and within this kind of evolutionary field of detective work that, you know, I recently had Lulu Miller on the show, and we talked about her beautiful book, Why Fish Don't Exist. And this very concept of like taxonomy is not a perfect science. And these are constructs. These are human invented constructs to try to make sense of try to make order out of disorder. And the truth is, usually things are ambiguous. Usually things are somewhere in between. There's a lot of gray. And why is it that we as human beings so desperately want to force people, objects, experiences into categories instead of saying it's okay if we're not, you know, we don't fit in a box perfectly?
Yeah, we don't like mess, or at least we call the mess, we call the mess outliers, and then decide not to think about it. But and what I'm about to say, I want to make it clear that I am not equating what queer and transgender people are going through is the same as the historic racism that Black people and many other cultures have gone through. But when I was writing Skeleton Keys, this point really struck me in terms of scientific racism in the past, that anthropology, for example, especially in America during the 18th and 19th centuries, it began as a racial science.
Yeah.
In that its main focus was there are five races. And that wasn't like we believe because we have gathered all this data. Like that was just the belief that existed.
Right. Like that was the starting point. Yeah.
Right. And everything got shunted into one of those five boxes. And then hierarchy started. And, you know, people started to come out with counter evidence to these categories that maybe they don't really exist. Maybe they're not as sort of set in stone as people wanted to believe. And oddly enough, it was not the science that made the difference. It was the fact that World War II happened and people saw what Nazi ideology did, the fixation on race and hierarchy, all the lives that were lost because of that. And that is what kind of turned anthropology saying like, oh no, we don't want to be preoccupied with race anymore. That this is a social construct and it's not a biological reality. And if we go too far down that road, is going to cause a lot of harm. And I think we're coming to a similar reckoning, at least in the spirit of it, with gender and sexuality and biological sex and some of these things that we've taken for granted for a long time. That, you know, this is kind of the way that it's always been done and always been categorized. But now we're questioning that, saying, is there a better way to understand this? And what is the social part of it? And what is the scientific part of it? And oftentimes, the biological part of it, the only people that that's relevant to are me, my doctor, and my partner. And that's it. Like, what chromosomes or gametes or hormone levels or whatever I have, that is not relevant to most of society as much as all these things are kind of put in the public eye, right?
Oh, you're so right. Like, just the obsessive focus on, like you mentioned, this very internal, you know, what gametes do I have? Where, what are my hormone, my blood hormone levels? But even on external kind of phenotypic expression of gender is bananas to me. How much people are obsessed with, like, what is, what isn't between one's legs? You know, kind of how are you wearing your body? And how does that make me feel as a passerby? Like, it's bizarre because in the cis world, only when it comes to, like, I don't know, overt sexual displays, only when it comes to dating or to pornography or to these kind of more private experiences, is guys aren't asking each other about their dicks. Like, it's just, it's so, it's such a weird thing that there's this obsession with trans people's genitals.
Right. And there are sort of two arguments on either side of that. And it depends on kind of which tact you want to take. One is that, well, it really doesn't matter what, like, if you, you know, care for someone, you're attracted to somebody, you know, if you want to have sex with them, does it really matter, like, what exact configuration their genitals are in? Because we have a whole bunch of variation, even within, like, if we were to take the binary biological sexes as standard, there's a ton of variation there to start with. And even if we look to other forms of nature, we know that these are homologous parts. I love Emily Nagoski's phrase in Come As You Are. That was primarily talking about cis women, but I think it applies more generally that these are the same parts, just shaped in different ways.
Yeah, and so, we see, and that during development. We see them turn into or move and morph in different ways, but the tissue is the same.
Yes, and we see this in other species. For example, like female spotted hyenas are a great example where they have a pseudopenis that's made out of the clitoris and they have what looks like a scrotum that's made out of the labia and stuff. And that happens because these are basically the same parts. And that's an example of these common developmental origins. And part of the reason that gender reassignment surgery or gender confirmation surgery works is because these are homologous parts. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about, like, even though I really want people to get this, from a human rights standpoint, I think we could do a lot better just educating everybody. This shouldn't just be something for trans people, for just everybody. Saying, like, okay, you see these two shapes, they look very, very different. They're actually made of the same parts, just in slightly different shapes from each other.
Right. But that also requires that people have an understanding about their own biology. And it's like, how tall an order is that really? I sometimes tell a story about when I had to go in for a biopsy, a cervical biopsy, and I was, you know, dating somebody at the time, and I told them about how scared I was because it was my first ever cervical biopsy, and they don't use anesthesia when they take these punch biopsies. And I remember just a bit of a callous response, a little bit of like humor, and just like somebody who clearly didn't understand what was going on. And then later when we talked about it, it became readily apparent to me that this person didn't really know what a cervix was. And once I started to describe exactly what was happening in the gynecologist's office, the empathy started to come out because they were like, holy shit, that's pretty traumatic. But it's like, until then it was like, oh, your lady bits are getting poked? Okay. Like, there's just lack of basic understanding of our own biology.
Yeah, and that's something where I wrote a piece for Slate a week or so ago about using science as not always the most effective tool against transphobia because it's not coming from a scientific place. Like, many of these people are the same people who, you know, are proposing creationist bills or don't agree that climate change is real. It's just kind of convenient to use that authority. But the corollary to that is that it would probably benefit everybody to have a better understanding of human biology and anatomy and how these parts relate to each other and kind of end this you know, will the girls report to the cafeteria and the boys report to the auditorium because they're going to watch a special movie, which is the system that we basically, and like, that's all we get. And you're kind of left on your own after that with this assumption that you're going to know how these things work just because they're.
Ugh, yeah, no, you're so, so right. And it's just personalizing ourselves, having a relationship with our own bodies, you know, celebrating, or at least at the very least, understanding the gray area and the sort of non-binary that does exist is you're right, sorely lacking in basic education, but also just in our social milieu, just talking about these things. But as you mentioned before, it is changing. I think younger people maybe it's only happening in the big cities. I don't know. But it does seem like there's, because of TikTok, because of Snapchat, because of the way that young people relate to each other on the internet, there's an expression and an exploration of the non-binary that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's amazing to see. I think that's the wonderful thing about, you know, kind of our information age, is that you can get information about just about any of these things that you want to know, you know, straight to your personal device. And like, I remember, like, as a kid, I wanted to learn about these things. I'd probably have to go to the library and get a book and feel really nervous about that, and then take it home and, you know, hide the book under my pillow or whatever else. Like now, especially with the proliferation of, you know, smartphones and, you know, just the availability of how much there is, like, I wish that, you know, like, my 12-year-old self could have gotten the education that I've gotten over the past couple of years and many of these things. Like, a lot more would have made sense. And I think that kind of openness of access and information is really making a huge difference.
Two things come up for me that I wanted to touch on before we maybe kind of move over into some paleo chat. The first one that comes up for me is something you said earlier really resonated for me at a personal level when you were talking about sort of that there's this frustration of needing to educate, but at the same time, understanding and sort of being honored by that fact, knowing that we're just at a certain place in time. I often think about, you know, Black History Month or women's history. And, you know, when I get interviewed about things, for example, like International Day of the Woman and Girl, is that what it's called? Or, you know, International Women's Day, basically. And do you celebrate for International Women's Day? And I'm like, no. And why not? Because it pisses me off that we have to have a day. Like, and I get the necessity for it. And I feel like really close to you know, to all of the women in my life. And so as, for example, as a trans woman, you have it doubly bad because you are identifying with this frustration that we women have together. I mean, that this idea that we have to have a fucking day because we're not the norm. And the only way to really celebrate or move forward is to draw attention to those issues. But then, of course, trans understanding, trans appreciation is a layer on top of that. That, yeah, I want there to be a future where we don't have to have a fucking day because every day is our day.
Yeah. And like every day is Catterday, really.
Yeah, exactly. But, can't we just all be Cat? Damn it.
That would make life so much better. But yeah, it's, I try and think of those days, like, I wouldn't say that I celebrate them because part of it is just like, I don't know how to do that other than just kind of being. Yeah. I'll take my estrogen and, you know, that's how I'll celebrate it. I'll light a candle. I don't know.
Right. It's like, I have boobs. Like, what else can we really do?
Yeah. It's like, yep, still grown. All right. We're good. But it's, I think, and that's the sort of, I don't want to say double-edged sword, but on the one hand, I'm glad that there's recognition. And on the other hand, I feel like This is the problem that we have with any of these things, right? Is that the people who are most likely to listen to us and most likely to understand and put things in motion, they're already on board. They're already paying attention. They already understand. The people that most need to hear it are just like, oh, why isn't there a man's day or a man's month or whatever else?
Racism. Yeah, all that shit.
Or they go like, you know, I'll see people like share things like, you know, Happy International Women's Day, but then there'll be a researcher who, you know, like, only publishes with co-authors who are men, or they'll run a conference where it's like primarily speakers who are men or whatever else. So it becomes like this kind insidious of tokenization.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of like, here's your cookie. Now for the rest of the time, we're going to do what we want. just, you know, I hope you have a nice day, like as if that's enough. And it's not used as a reminder of like, oh, we should be working with this, like as just part of life, that, you know, that bringing up this background level till we get to equity and equality and justice. And I think it's so, that's the part that seems like maddeningly hard to get some people to understand, because it often gets right into that defensiveness and is like, well, what about my day?
Well, yeah, and exhausting. I see it all the time on SGU when we get the really sexist emails. And then, you know, sometimes I have the patience to educate, and other times I just get pissed. And the guys are like, we got to use these as learning experiences. And I'm like, you don't know. You don't know what it's like. Like, I don't want to have to wear kid gloves every day. I don't want to have to massage egos. I don't want to have to coddle. I want to just be pissed. You know what I mean? Yeah. Come on. And also,
it's exhausting right now being like a trans person, especially because like it's basically watching yourself be vivisected in, you know, magazines and, you know, on Capitol Hill and everywhere else, like people talking about your, I mean, the fact like how many politicians right now are referring to trans women, because the focus is always on trans women. And it's like, I don't want trans mask people to be like drawn into this because they don't need the grief. But the focus is so much on people like me, and we're always referred to as biological males and like all these details of our bodies and our sexualities, like put on public display, but without our voices. It's not a trans person saying like, I'm going to share with this with you in the hope that you understand. It's always a cis person talking about us, and then we get to hear it, and then we don't get our voices heard. And that's the part that really like grinds me down, or at least like I need to walk away from the computer and walk jet for a couple minutes and then come back to it.
Oh, I can't. I mean, it's obviously I feel great empathy, but I have no idea what that's like. And it sounds fucking exhausting.
But I mean, it's I really hate saying it, but it's similar to what, you know, cis women had to deal with for so very long as well, like in order to get the vote, in order to get like anything even approaching equity and equality, like having IQ levels and, you know, emotions and hormones and stuff like brought up, like, you know, we're not bringing that up as directly anymore, but it's still the same kind of story where it's like the detail, the biological details of who you are being used to determine your validity as a person. And that's the part that I think, like, in one way or another, a lot of people have either dealt with or can empathize with.
So, you know, the second thing that comes up for me that I think speaks to exactly what we've been talking about is how do you perceive and how do you kind of work with the spectrum of individuals to whom you are, you know, oftentimes forced to interact with? There's the gamut. There's the individuals who are probably pretty social justice oriented, who are anti-racist, who are, you know, celebrate inclusivity, and maybe sometimes stumble, but you it's very clear if you're misgendered and they literally made a mistake that they're like, holy shit, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that. You've got the other end of the gamut, which are people who are, you know, burdened and put upon and angry about the fact that you exist, and they're transphobic. They're just fundamentally don't like you and think that you shouldn't have rights. And then you've got these people in between who I often hear are like the sort of passive, and unfortunately, you know, it's like the letter from a Birmingham jail version that Martin Luther King talked about the white moderate, and how sometimes the white moderate is more dangerous than the Klanner because they would just prefer the status quo, but they pretend like they're on your team. So these people who are kind of like, I don't get it. I'm just old. I'm sorry. Like, just, I'm sorry. I can't keep up with, are you a boy? Are you a girl? I just don't get it. And like, you know, dealing with those three kinds of buckets, I'm just wondering what your experience has been, what your approach is like. How do you make sense of that kind of world that you're having to navigate?
It's pretty much what you described. If somebody is just like very virulently and outwardly transphobic, I check out of that situation usually relatively early.
Right. I mean, it's not like safe for you to be in that situation. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And any further interaction kind of only kind of raises the tension or the concern about that. You know, like block and report is basically my response to that. And people who are generally on board and, you know, like, you know, might slip every once in a while with, you know, a dead name, misgendering, or a, you know, idea that's, you know, not quite right. I generally feel like I'm able to just say like, hey, like, it's not a big deal, but just so you know, like, you just he, him, like, referring to me in email, it'd mean a lot to me if you just, you know, kept an eye on that. And then usually, like, they are much more apologetic than I kind of need them to be in a way. Yeah. That's actually the most difficult part of it, where it's kind of like, you're like, oh, it doesn't have to be a big deal. I'm okay.
I wonder sometimes if the psychological process of being like, holy shit, I'm so fucking sorry. Almost like you said some, you know, you're like, hey, Jennifer. And they're like, well, my name's Jamie. And you're like, oh shit. That like, if you really make it a bigger deal than it is, then it has an emotional connotation attached to it. So now you're going to remember it more. Like, I don't know. I mean, and that's not even a justification, but I'm wondering if part of the reason that we as human beings are like overly sorry when things like that happen is because then it's like not making that mistake again, because I've just burned myself on the stove.
Yeah. And how much of it is, you know, those of us with anxiety high, how much of this is like our normal thought process, right? It's like we remember the one small thing that went wrong. And then everything else that was fine, like, we don't hold on to, but we'll fixate on, like, can't believe I said that word wrong.
Oh, like, right. Like, you publish an article and you get 99% good feedback. And then the one person who's like, you're a dick. And you're like, no.
Right. And that's all it takes. It doesn't have to be like a cogent point. It's just like, I don't like you. I'm just like, but you're right in that it's usually the people in the middle is the most of all, like, especially early on. And I'd hear this from folks who are older than me for the most part. It was, well, we're trying. This is new. And part of it's like, it takes more assessment. Okay, like, how do I want to respond to this? And those are the moments where I'm really weighing, and do I want to make this an educational moment, or am I just too fucking tired right now? You know, if I want to make an educational moment, I'm going to say like, okay, like, I know that my change in identity is new for you, but transgender people have been around for basically as long as there have been people, and there are people who have been medically transitioning since basically, you know, before World War II. So here's some resources on that if you would like to know more. I'm trying to like assume the best, that they're feeling annoyed, but there's also like an interest or a bit of curiosity. If I can get at that part, then maybe it'll change. But I think outside of my personal sphere where I have that kind of, I don't want to say kind of pull, but like, I know people are more likely to listen because they're already invested in, you know, a friendship or an acquaintance or a connection. That's the stuff that makes me really worry. Like I mentioned Abigail Schreier earlier, the fact that she has a book that was, you know, it sold at Target, you know, like all across the country, was pulled and then put back on the shelf. And of course, the controversy was more publicity, that this isn't a book that, you know, it's going to go to number one because of TERFs or something, or that it's something that's going to reach people who are hearing, like, I hear there's controversy over transgender people. This seems like an interesting book to read about that subject. And they come away with entirely the wrong idea and perception about this, because we don't know how to research. Another thing we don't teach people is how to research and vet things and understand it. That, like, especially in journalism right now, and this is a whole other point that we have to get into because we have fossils and stuff to talk about too. But the fact that how many articles about trans and queer and non-binary people are written by cisgender people, because there's a belief that that's inherently more objective.
Oh, and that these people are kind of disgusting.
Yes. And I feel like that's something where in, you know, sort of the writing and journalism world, like, people still don't get that. They still don't understand that, because they coming from the standpoint, it's like, well, if you're trans, you're kind of just advocating for yourself. It's like, this person is like doxing the people that they talk about. How is that okay?
Right. And I think I see it a lot in the skeptic movement. Like, we'll get emails from people who are like, I heard Jordan Peterson tell a talk about how there's not really 250 gender. And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? Or like, you know, I heard from Richard Dawkins, or I heard from Sam Harris. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you don't realize that just because these people are people that within your community you look up to for certain points, that there are fundamental problems with value judgments here, that these are individuals who are known transphobes or individuals who are known sexists, and you're looking at them as if they're objective.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that plays into it. It's like, well, since they're not part of that community, they must have a better and more objective understanding of it.
Right.
And if that's the case, it's like, how do you possibly argue against that?
Right, because it goes back to the fundamental problem, which I discussed a few weeks ago when I had an individual who is a feminist philosopher on the show and who wrote Think Like a Feminist, Carol Hay, and talked about her experience because she's married to a trans man. And we talked about TERFs and we talked about all of this. But what it came down to at its core was this fundamental belief that's very hard to shake, that the cis, white, Protestant, straight man is the norm and everything else is the other.
Mm-hmm. And the entitlement that comes with that, the entitlement to know about, like, not what we're willing to share, but invasively know about our bodies and what they're like, what they do. It's like, you know, do I know you? Did you buy me a drink? Are you asking me out?
Right?
No? Yeah. Then leave me the fuck alone. Like,
you're so right. And you see it time and time again, those cringeworthy interviews on like talk shows where it's like, so how do you have sex? And they're like, wow, I can't believe you just asked me that, like in public, like in front of all these people. I'm not answering that. What are you even talking about? How do you have sex?
Exactly.
Come on.
Like, let's talk about what that word means to us.
Yeah, like, what are all of your kinks? I'd love to hear about them on air in front of everyone. Like, no. Come on.
Yes, I'm sure, you know, 13 minutes of intercourse at 10 o'clock at night on Saturday weekly is very exciting for you. There is a greater world out there.
Oh my God. I love it. I love it. So anyway, Riley, so, I mean, there's so much more that we could get into, and maybe more things will come up in the next kind of 15 minutes as we're talking, but if not, that's okay. Because as you mentioned, mm-hmm. you've written some pieces that are, I think, really, really important, and I'll link to them in the show notes. In the meantime, though, I'd love to talk bones. I'd love to talk fossils. Yeah. I'd love to talk dinos. You know, I see your byline a lot. I know that you're writing for all of these incredible outlets that a lot of my listeners listen to. Anytime something comes up in my feed reader that you've authored, I often share it. So you probably see that I often share your pieces on social media. What's kind of the newest and the juiciest for you that you've been able to sink your teeth into? What have you really enjoyed writing lately?
Well, first I'll say that I won't make you wait another 6 years to come back. So we'll have plenty of time to talk about other stuff if we need to.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yes. So some of the things that I've been writing about lately, like one of the really neat paleo things, it was neat to see it quantified because this has been an idea that's been, and there's finally a paper that gets at the mechanics of it. So when we think about the Hell Creek Formation, so we think about like the time of like T-Rex and Triceratops and stuff, ancient Montana and the Dakotas, 66 million years ago, you don't have a lot of medium-sized carnivores. You have a lot of very small, like raptor-like kind of little nippy carnivore-type things. And then you basically have T-Rex, and T-Rex just dominates everything. And that's kind of weird because when you look at other dinosaur habitats, like other ecologies, you have small carnivores, and you've got your like mid-class carnivores, and you've got your gigantic carnivores, and they kind of like fill the whole ecosystem. In Hell Creek, it's basically T-Rex is running the show. And it seems that the way that as dinosaurs grew up, they changed so dramatically that if there's a skeleton called Jane, that's a teenage T-Rex, a 13-year-old T-Rex with a long, shallow skull. And these like the teeth seem really long because the skull is so small. Then you compare that to an adult and the skull of the adult is like really deep and really like kind of burly looking. And it looks like an entirely different animal.
Right. Here in LA, have you seen, sorry to interject, here in LA, there's this really great T-Rex growth series at the Museum of Natural History that I've always loved, always, it's, you know, it was only probably came up like 10 years ago, but I've always really loved it because it shows, you know, a young T-Rex, a juvenile, or like a teenage T-Rex, and then an adult T-Rex, and how historically we didn't know, are these different species? Now we kind of think, okay, these are just growth stages, and it really speaks to that detective work of paleontology of like, we got a few bones. We got to make sense of what's going on in the lifespan, in the ecosystem, in the, you know, just from a taxonomic perspective. There's so many of these cool questions and complicated issues in paleo that I think we often think it's old and it's dusty and we just know everything about it. You get a tooth, because that's how it's related in the literature, right? It's like, or in oftentimes in old school science communication, like we found a tooth, we know it's from an ankylosaur and it was this age and this is when it lived and case closed. And it's like, oh, really? From a tooth?
Right. And that's how we communicate. We communicate like what we consider the facts of, but not like the process or any of the other things are going. Like, you've got 500 words to make sense of all this. It's like, oh God, how am I going to do this? But in this particular case, it's really neat because, like you said, this came out of all these different realizations that, like, oh, these are not different species. These are growth stages of one animal that are acting kind of like different species. Mm-hmm. So they're filling different niches in the same environment and basically shouldering out any competition. So you have less species diversity because one species is acting like three.
And so is it because the lifespan is like long? Like, how old did T. rexes get? Do we have any idea?
They got the oldest ones that we know of were about 33 years old.
Okay. So kind of like, you know, people's lifespan has always been long, but because of disease and stuff, there were eras.
But that's not a bad comparison because T-Rex got to, you know, it was kind of this like very awkward, gangly, like fuzzy, like we've all gone through our awkward teenage phase. T-Rex had one as well until about 15. And then they go through this growth spurt. It's kind of like, remember those old like Charles Atlas ads where it's like the kind of like 90-pound weakling, and then if you work out using my method, it's basically that kind of transformation where it's going from this like tiny awkward little thing into all of a sudden you get like 9 tons of carnivore that can like crunch bone.
Yeah, that can eat the lawyer right off of the porta potty. Yeah,
exactly. So this was study quantified that in T-Rex, it kind of made sense of this, like, okay, yeah, like this species is really kind of shouldering out other competitors. And even in other habitats where there are medium-sized carnivores, they're relatively rare. So it seems that these giant dinosaur species, things like Allosaurus and T-Rex and Carcharodontosaurus and all, you know, our other favorites, that they, you know, since they hatched out of these little eggs and they had to grow up into animals that could be, you know, 40 feet long and 9 tons, that through those growth stages, that they basically took up so much ecological space that there wasn't much room for other things to evolve. So it's not like the African savanna today where you have a whole bunch of lions and a whole bunch of bat-eared foxes and spotted hyenas and things like that. And it's everybody's relatively well represented. It was very uneven during the Mesozoic, and that's kind of weird.
It's as if lions had these long stages where you had the lion kittens and then you had the lion teenagers and then you had the lion adults, and they took up the space of, like you said, the hyenas or the leopards or the cheetahs.
Yeah. So that was one of the neat things. I wrote that for New Scientist based out of the UK. So that's up on their website. And then one of the other things that I've been working on, and this should come out shortly, is about this. I need to be a little bit mama. Like, I can give you the outline. But it's about this fossil shark that was found in Mexico. And it seems to have almost like manta ray-like pectoral fins.
Oh, weird.
And this will come out this week in Science. And it was basically this filter feeder that had this combination of propulsion that's never been seen before, right? It had like kind of like a shark-like body that could kind of swish its tail back and forth and kind of propel it forward. But they could also like flap with these big manta-like wings.
Wow.
And, like, nobody has ever seen a shark like this before.
And is this it's clearly a shark, or is it one maybe a precursor to shark? You know, because sharks and rays are pretty related, aren't they?
Yeah, they're relatively closely related to each other. They're part of the same group of animals called elasmobranchs. Mm-hmm. So I think rays split off from like an archaic form of shark sometime during prehistory. So this is something that the authors of the paper are proposing, that it's a shark, and that it's a shark that's acting like a whale shark or a basking shark with just these big kind of flappy wings on it. But some of the other researchers that I spoke to and reported in this piece said, like, I'm not entirely sure that it is a shark, or maybe that all these pieces go together. This is the problem that we have with some of these papers that come out in like major journals like Nature and Science, and that they seem very dramatic and they hit, you know, very hard as kind of like, we found something that's never been seen before and it looks like this. But when you go into the supplemental information where like the data is, there aren't always good photographs or good figures. And that seems to be the case here with, like, if this is true, nobody has seen a shark like this before. But there are some questions about this that we need either another one or like more intensive study to really be sure. And that's the stuff I'm trying to include that in my reporting, because I feel like we often don't say that. Scientists often, like, we found it a new thing, put it on the shelf. And I think it's worth saying, like, this could be really cool, But there's a whole bunch of reasons that it might not actually exist.
Right. And even if it did exist, there's often those questions too about coming back to that conversation we were having before about taxonomy and where does it fit? And is it a ray-like shark? Is it a shark-like ray? I mean, maybe not in this situation, but I long struggled with that with Archaeopteryx. That's why I love Archaeopteryx so much. Yeah, I get it. It's a bird. People talk about it like it's a bird, but in my view, it's a dinosaur, damn it. Like, I've always held on to it as a dinosaur because it's sort of both. And that's really cool.
Exactly. Well, I remember it's so difficult communicating this sometimes because I've tried to tackle this in some of my writing and I've asked paleontologists about it, where if you ask a paleontologist, okay, what makes a dinosaur, or what makes a bird a bird? Or you can, you know, do this with almost any group. And if you ask the dinosaur question, they say, okay, well, dinosaurs seem to share a certain number of specific anatomical traits with each other that other animals don't. Okay, I can get that. There's a certain like crest on the humerus or the upper arm bone. The hip socket's arranged a certain way. I can get that. The problem is like sometimes through evolution, those traits change or, you know, they're not the same. So the ancestor had it, but the descendant doesn't. But it's still a dinosaur, though. So, like, okay, that's not a foolproof method to do this. The other way to do it is to look at the family tree and say everything between basically a triceratops and a pigeon, if you trace those back to the last common ancestor, everything that falls in between is a dinosaur. And that's also kind of unsatisfying in its way, because then, like, if you don't know at the outset what all the different families and everything else is, it's very hard to visualize. So this is like where we get into the philosophy of science and systematics and all this stuff, where it really can be a challenging thing to communicate. And, you know, Archaeopteryx is a great example because we recognize it as the first bird because it was described as the first bird. We basically said, okay, we're making this the first bird.
Yeah.
If another animal had been found with very similar traits, and we've got them like in an even older set of, those probably would have been named as the first bird, and kind of what our metric is would have been different. And this doesn't mean that the whole thing like doesn't make any sense, but there is a kind of arbitrary nature to some of these things, or at least historical reasons for some of this. So when people are expecting this biological answer of like, we know it is because it has feathers, or, you know, the answer someone might want, it really has to do with like, well, like at the time, this thing seemed to be like right in the middle. So we just kind of took it from there.
Yeah. You know, and it speaks to those kind of longstanding internet wars about like, well, birds are dinosaurs, clearly, or like a taco is a sandwich, God damn it. Like, that's a whole box we're not going to open up today. So Riley, you know, there's so much more that we could talk about, but before sort of I close it up, because we're getting close to the hour, I'm wondering, you know, before I ask you my closing two questions that I always ask, I'm wondering what is sort of on the horizon for you now? Any big projects, or are they all secret? You know, like, is there anything you can share with us about kind of where you're at and what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm working on a lot of different projects for a lot of different publications right now. I'm working on a piece for Sierra about natural history in the West, specifically relating to Utah's national monument, like Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase, the ones that Trump cut. But why that happened, why that wasn't a decision that he made, but speaks to this kind of land war mentality that's existed since the time that the Mormons settled in Salt Lake, this kind of idea of the Sagebrush Rebellion. So that's something that'll be out in a few months.
Cool. So there's a lot of like history of science and history of just like politics in this.
And they all inform each other. Yeah, it's not just sort of the bones in the ground, but like, why is this ground so contested? And then I'm writing a piece for Smithsonian about, just since we were talking about fossil sharks before, about strange fossil sharks, things like Helicoprion that had that buzzsaw, like lower jaw.
I another remember one called, that yeah. discovery. Yeah,
it was really neat. Another one called Edestis, that looks like it was like pinking shears for jaws. Like, why did things seem so much weirder, you know, like 250 million years ago?
Right. So and so much more badass. Why did everything look like this barbaric like tool back in the day?
Right. And I'll give you like a spoiler for it. Like, okay, we actually have more disparity or more different kinds of jaw shapes now. It's just since those are so different, we think of that time as so much odder than it really was. There actually are more varieties of like shark and ray and stuff like swimming around now. But because they're here now, we don't appreciate them as.
Right. There's a normalcy to them. So we don't see them as aberrant or different.
Yes. And then the big thing is I'm writing a book about And hopefully this will come out in winter of next year, about if you were to stand in the Hell Creek Formation that we were talking about a few minutes ago, 66 million years ago when that asteroid struck the Yucatan, what would you experience in the second, the hour, the day, the week, the month, the year, and so on, like after that impact? Like, how would you see the environment around change? So it's trying to put the reader in that environment as much as possible. It's kind of, I describe it as like the forest unseen, but on fire 66 million years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hoping to wrap up. Now, I'm really excited about that because it's using science to tell a more narrative story and really put you in this place and not just talk facts and figures and velocities and things like that. But like, what did this mean for this environment and how it was this basically the worst day, the worst single day the Earth has ever had or life on Earth has had. And then this recovery that came after it. So it's kind of like the dinosaurs and their destruction is the hook, but it's really a story about life's resilience.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I can't wait to read that. You better hurry up and write that so I can read it, Riley.
I'll send you a sample of it.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Oh, I love it. So I don't know if you remember back when you were on the show, but we always closed each episode by asking the guests the same two big picture questions. So I'm going to pose them to you again. I have no idea what you said the first time because dumb me didn't think to go back and look. Okay, good, good, good. I was like, maybe it'd be interesting to compile this in the future. This is a project for another day.
Well, a different person now, right? So it'll be interesting to compare and contrast.
Absolutely. So Riley, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, whether it's personal, whether it's global, whether it's cosmic, I'm wondering first, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night, the thing that's really worrying you, you know, where you might even feel a bit pessimistic about it? And on the flip side, what are you genuinely hopeful for? What are you, you know, optimistic about? What are you truly looking forward to?
I think the thing that keeps me up at night the most is climate change and just knowing how much, like looking at the prehistoric past, these moments where we've had these spikes and how long they last and the effects that they have, where it's like we're just moving too slow for what we know is coming down the pipe. I'm really hoping that that can change, but something that it's so big that it's hard to feel like, can I even do anything about this? So that's what's keeping me up at night in that sense. In a positive sense, I think it relates back to what you said before, that like through this struggle that we're having right now about gender and identity and being queer and biology and what all that means, basically what it means to be human in many of these aspects, that is changing. It's going to change. And the picture 10, 20, 30 years from now is going to be very different. That I'm going to meet people who, you know, at, you know, like age 55 or say like, you know what, I wasn't really sure I was happy with my gender. I decided to experiment with it. My friends are really supportive. I decided to keep doing what I'm doing, but I'm really glad that I did that. And I learned a lot. Like those are the sorts of stories I think we're going to hear more of. And I think we're just going to increase our empathy for each other and really expand the expression that we have as people. So that's what I'm really hopeful for.
There's going to be a time in the future where we meet people who are like 55 and we say, when did you know you were trans? They're like, oh, I was like 4 or 5. And so when did you? Oh, yeah, I've just always been trans. Like, this is just my identity.
I already get the feelings of like back in my day. Like,
yeah, right.
It's already happening.
We're old, Riley. Oh, no.
Shh, don't tell anybody.
Well, Riley, thank you so much for being on the show today. I mean, it was, as always, a massive pleasure, but I'm so glad that we were able to reconnect.
Oh, this is always so much fun. Thank you for asking me.
Of course, and everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.